This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Quick, name a philanthropist. Let me help you. Andrew Carnegie, Warren Buffett, Bono, George Soros, Michael Bloomberg. So far, all men, but then there's Bill and Melinda Gates, Michael and Susan Dell. Locally, there's Leon and Sandra Levine. The point being, when we think of philanthropists, men usually come to mind. Women enter the picture on the arms of their husbands, but that is a highly inaccurate picture. In fact, 60% of the decisions about where philanthropic money is being spent are being made by women. And the trouble is, not even women know this. So this hour, we meet three women working to raise awareness of the impact women are having on charitable giving and empowering women to have an even greater effect on their communities by increasing the influence of the money they give. We meet them in advance of a Charlotte conference on the topic. Diane Bailey is co-chair of the Women's Collective Giving Forum and past president of the board of the Women's Impact Fund. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Delighted to be here.
She joins us in our studio, and with us from Boston is Virginia Mills, board chair of the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, and also one of the people responsible for a similar organization to what we have here in Charlotte in Boston as well. Thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here, Mike. Thank you.
And the same is true for Colleen Willoughby, who is joining us by phone from Seattle, where she is the founder of the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network and of the Washington Women's Foundation. Thank you for joining us, too. The organization, Colleen, that you founded, the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, is an umbrella organization that serves – the number kept changing as I read yesterday. I think it serves 46 groups in 23 states with a membership of about 10,000 women who have given nearly $70 million in grants to nonprofits throughout the country. When did you form this organization and why?
Okay. Thank you very much for that nice introduction. And we formed the organization in 1995. But in the early 90s, what prompted my thinking about this is I was doing two jobs at the same time. Actually, I've always liked people to know that I'm a product of my history. Being an 80-year-old woman, I've been in the volunteer trenches for about 55 years. And at the time, in the early 90s, I was doing two jobs. One as a volunteer. I was a trustee of a small college in Washington, and I was chair of the annual fund. And at the same time, in a paid position, I was helping a friend who was the executive of our local campfire try to raise $1 million for their camp. And both required my working with large gifts. I was seeking big money at the time, and asking women that I knew in both of these various organizations, and thought that would be a rather easy thing to do in that today women's wealth is rising. Unfortunately, in both of those situations, at a college and at a nonprofit organization like Campfire, I recognized that there was a disconnect between women's capacity and their confidence to use their money in some larger ways. And that was a disconnect because at the same time, some of the statistics that you just mentioned, women's wealth was beginning to grow, but the needs of the community were also growing.
And you also say that 20 years ago, no one was asking women to be philanthropists.
No, they weren't, because it wasn't assumed that women were the ones who held the wealth. You introduced this by saying that it was very often on the arms of their husbands. And this picture is changing. This is a societal picture that's changing, because over this last several decades, women have been able to have higher education, which leads to careers that are much more remunerative than the ones that I was sort of introduced to 60 years ago. So women have been earning their own wealth. I say there's two kinds of women. They're the newly minted. Those are my daughters and the young people on your program that are joining me. But there's also, in my generation, the newly discovered. And I think they have found that they do have voice in families and are making some of these decisions. But there was a need for training. I've always said that philanthropy is a learned behavior, and you don't make a large gift that you give away if you don't really understand how to do it. It's no different than investing in the stock market.
There are also societal myths that are being debunked. There's a presentation by the director of the Women's Philanthropy Institute, Deborah Mesh.
Right.
And in that presentation, she says there these perceptions are that women are less philanthropic than men, that they defer to their husbands in household charitable decision-making, and that they don't make big gifts. And all of those things are not true. So I'm just curious, maybe Virginia could jump in here on this. I'm curious as to why these perceptions persist.
I'm not sure I can say why these perceptions persist, but we are here to help dispel those. We agree they don't exist. And we are training and helping women do the exact opposite, to handle their money themselves within the collective by working together, by learning together. It is a way women like to be. Women, not all women, but many women enjoy being together and doing things together for their community.
And that's not just a generational thing. Di, I'm going to bring you in because I think that you are the youngest person in the room here today. And you've been interested in this since you were in college, this kind of philanthropy and helping others succeed through collective work among a group of people, correct?
That's exactly right, Mike. I think it would be useful to step back just for a moment for the listeners to understand the model.
Okay.
Women's collective giving is a new form of philanthropy. What we do as individuals is we pool our resources together, and then as a group, in a very democratic grassroots process, dole out these contributions in large numbers. So for the Women's Impact Fund, for example, we have 400 plus members contribute $1,000 to that grant-making pool. And then at the end of the day, we divide it up among five organizations, one in the arts, education, environment, health, and human services. The minimum we would give is $40,000, up to a max of $100,000. And so that way, we together learn about how we can really move the meter philanthropically in our communities. It's a very, very powerful model and one that is widespread.
How long has the Women's Impact Fund been in existence here in Charlotte?
So Mary Lou Babb and Claire Tate founded the organization in 2003. So we're in our 12th grant-making cycle. We have given $4 million to our community, 54 grants.
And who were some of the recipients?
Our very first recipient was Pat's Place. It's a center for victims of sexual abuse, children, and for their families who are the non-offenders. We have given grants, again, 54, to a range of organizations, everything from small new organizations to larger institutions that are familiar to all of us.
Virginia, one of the biggest reasons that women who don't give is that they are simply not asked to give. And the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network started with 8 women. It's grown to 10,000 women. Are you bringing new philanthropists, new female philanthropists into the process? And are some of these women the people who weren't asked prior to their involvement in the various organizations that make up your collective?
Indeed, that is exactly the purpose of the WCGN, which is the acronym for us. We support the creation, development, and expansion of these women collective giving groups around the country. And it is because the model that Colleen established almost 20 years ago, it is still replicating itself around the country. And we are finding organizations are popping up all over the country, and they are finding us because they want to learn how to do it better and how to do it well. They are joining them within their own communities saying, we would like to learn how to do this. We have the capacity to do so. And we say, yes, you do. And we're here to help you.
And when you started this, Colleen, I guess you started it in Seattle, in that area in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
Did you intend for this to be a national model, or did it just kind of grow on its own?
It did grow. No, I didn't. I can't say that I was that foresighted to think of it as a national model. But we started having meetings. Actually, the concept of a conference actually started in Boise. The Boise group was one that was one of the early, along with Charlotte. Charlotte was an early founded organization, and we met in Boise in about 2008, I think it was. And at the end of that meeting, there was a discussion, well, what do we do now? And there were two things that came out of that meeting. One was, let's join our forces and learn together. So we established webinars for the whole network, and let's continue this idea of a national conference. So that was about the beginning of the collective nature of all of the collectives, and it has just continued to grow. It is even growing globally now, not necessarily out of our network, but I have been asked, and we do now have a fund in Shanghai and two in Australia. So I think it's a product of the time. I think that it's with women's learning and having their own money as well as having more voice in their families. Philanthropy has always been something that we have given to, we have fundraised for, but using your own money to invest in something that you really care about, as Diane said, there's environment, there's social services, there's health, there's education. It's a new experience to see results of your investment that you really are engaged in. I think the word engagement is something we use a lot because our members really do all of the grant-making processes. They research communities to find out where could they bring something new to the community or where could we strengthen something or what is the process of due diligence? How do you review the financials of an organization? All of those processes in grant-making that have traditionally been done by staffs of the organizations like community foundations or family foundations, the corporate responsibility foundations, our women members are doing themselves. And you learn a lot from that process, but you're also inspired to do more.
As I understand this, Diane, the local organizations make the decisions on how much money and who that money will go to. It's not the umbrella organization. The umbrella organization serves as the model and a support system. Is that correct?
Exactly. WCGN works to disseminate best practices and also to nurture the growth of new organizations and communities where they don't have a collective giving organization.
You know, as I read this yesterday, it seems that WCGN, which is the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, it's a mouthful, it's kind of a united way. It's not, let me finish my thought here, because she's saying, no, it's not. But the model is kind of a united way, where people are collectively pooling their money to support various different organizations. How is it different, since you were so adamantly opposed to my saying that? How is it different?
Well, for one thing, it's women.
Yes.
which is actually, I think, for all of us that have self-selected to be part of this organization, remember, you're not invited to join the Women's Impact Fund or any of our groups, although we are very active in recruiting new members. Raise your hand, and the invitation is always there. We welcome all women to come and to join our organizations. But one of the other things that I think is really important is that in addition to pooling our grant-making dollars, we're also providing educational opportunities to learn and grow with community engagement.
We'll talk more about how this model works, how it's grown the field of women who are participating in controlling where their money goes and watching the impact of that money, which is the key thing I think Colleen mentioned a moment ago. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Womble Carlyle, whose attorneys provide business solutions to middle market executives at companies that drive the economy. More information at gettoknowwomble.com. And Blackhawk Hardware, located in the Park Road Shopping Center, locally owned and mismanaged since 1977. Blackhawk, where hardware, home, and garden meet. Info at blackhawkhardware.com. Since the dawn of time, we have pondered this question: where did we come from? Scientists have inched ever closer to an answer, but we still don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle, and it seems every time we get closer, some new finding creates more questions than answers. And that is the case with the recent discovery of a new species, an ancient human ancestor. We're going to talk about that discovery and what it could mean for the human family tree tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S., Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea have emerged as major players in the new world of cyber warfare. Global security threats posed by increasingly sophisticated malware and the new digital arms race.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the increasing role women have to play in philanthropy, even if they don't know it, and the impact they can have as in pooling their resources through something called the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, the WCGN. Sounds like a radio station. Here in our studio in Charlotte, Diane Bailey, co-chair of the National Leaders Forum, Women's Collective Giving Forum, I should say, and also president of the Women's Impact Fund here in Charlotte. Joining us by phone from Seattle is the founder of the WCGN and also the founder of the Washington Women's Foundation, another charitable group. And Virginia Mills joins us from a studio someplace in Boston where she is the board chair of the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network. You are, Diane, an attorney for Robinson, Bradshaw and Hinson. You started the firm's nonprofit practice group, advising the clients that you bring in on corporate governance and tax compliance and charitable solicitation. You've also served on boards that are both raising money and boards that are seeking money. So you've been on both sides of this equation. Asking for money, to me, seems like a difficult task. But since you've been on both sides, is it?
Not if you've got the right project that you're working on. And I find, particularly with inviting women to join the Women's Impact Fund, it's such a gift to them personally to be able to connect with a vibrant, engaged, diverse group of women and also have this insider's view into the nonprofit sector in Charlotte. I'm a true believer, as are, I think, every member, as is every member of the Women's Impact Fund, that the private sector and the government can only do so much to make our world more humane, more livable, more vibrant. And the nonprofits have a really critical role to play. And for us to be on the front lines of the philanthropic engagement, really learning how to invest our dollars in ways that are move the meter to make our city stronger is such a gift that to invite people to join while it has a price tag associated with it is really quite a gift.
You're young, so you have a generational perspective that is perhaps different from other people. And you're also an attorney, and you work a lot with men. Talk to me about the difference in how men perceive philanthropy and how women, maybe you can, maybe you can't, but if you can, talk about the difference between how men and women perceive philanthropy.
Well, obviously you make broad generalizations right. In responding to a question like that.
Well, I ask because I did a lot of reading yesterday, and it seems that men are less generous overall.
I'll be careful in how I respond to that. I will say that men can be a little more transactional in their philanthropy, sometimes a little bit more interested on in where their name might appear on a sign or perhaps on a building.
Ego.
And not that that's not important, right? Mm-hmm. There is an important aspect to recognition in that it might inspire others to do the same or perhaps even to do more. Women, I think, and the research also bears out, are more engaged on the front lines with their giving. Often with their contribution of dollars also comes their engagement personally, whether it's serving on a board or volunteering on a committee or engaging in more direct service with an organization. You get both. You get our passion and our investment.
I'd be interested in your perspective on that as well, Virginia and Colleen. And also, I think one of the things that she speaks to here, and I think one of the things that your organization is all about is not just asking for the money. It's asking the women who are giving the money to be involved at the point where they make the decisions.
Let me add a little bit to that. This is Colleen. We don't really ask for money. We really seek membership to the organization. And every member in all of our organizations, the equity in our organizations is really beautiful because every member contributes exactly the same thing. Every community can choose what level of contribution they want. In Seattle, Washington, for example, our contribution level is $2,000. Others can be $10 or $100. I mean, you gear that to your local community and how you feel about it. But the point is that we're not asking people to give us money. We're inviting women to become members of this organization where they can learn. And as we've been talking, I think that one of the attractive things, and say a major difference between the collective giving organizations and the United Way, for example, and I've put my time in on United Way channels a lot, but I would like to share with you what our criteria for the grants that we make. This is, and as you said, the more important part is how do we use this pool of money that members have contributed into the community. The three goals or the criteria that the Seattle Washington Women's Foundation uses are an emergent need. There are several lately, the floods and the fires and that sort of thing. That would be considered an emergent need that you might participate in. Another one is a bold new venture, and I would love to tell you about one, but this there's a lot being said in the press and so forth about venture philanthropy. Actually, most philanthropy is venture philanthropy if you're a true philanthropist. And the third criteria that our group uses is a new solution to an age-old problem. One very quick example of that is we have an organization that places foster care children. Babies, infants, are very easy to place. The older child that has been in and out of many, many homes is not that easy. Our grant 1 year to this organization gave them the capacity to hire a staff person that could work exclusively with those kinds of children. The bold new venture was our funding of a doctor at Children's Hospital who had an idea. The idea was to create a paint that could follow a child's tumor, and apparently tumors were the significant reasons for early demise of infants. That gentleman now has finally, after 17 years of work, been granted the Drug Administration or whatever the legal authority is to have clinical trials, but it has also moved from being a paint that helps physicians identify tumors in infants to men's prostate cancer. So this was taking a risk on something that wasn't proven, and I like to use a quote that an actor friend of mine says, dare to risk possibilities and act with audacious enthusiasm. And I think that is the difference, not that the end result might be different, because United Way does wonderful things, but in the collective giving organizations, the members themselves are really engaged in finding these places to place their money that they can be then engaged in over a long period of time.
So Colleen mentioned these three goals. Are those the same three goals that you, Diane, with the Women's Impact Fund would have, or do you have different goals or similar goals?
They're similar goals. It also raises the issue of misconceptions about women's collective giving. I think many people in our community assume that we only fund projects related to women and girls, which is absolutely not the case. We do tend to favor those projects if you look carefully at our 54 grants over the years, but that is not our focus. We do tend to fund new initiatives and new projects, but we are certainly not limited to that. Particularly in the Great Recession, we were very, very thoughtful about investing in proven successful programs that might have needed additional capital during those difficult days.
How difficult was it, Virginia, in the recession to keep this all going? Because everything kind of just collapsed for a couple of years there, it seems.
Indeed, it was a difficult time for everyone, but this model is so natural, it's so organic, that it did not falter. Each of these organizations that we've talked about, whether it's in Charlotte, Seattle, or our other 46 members, and we are always looking to gain more, are so capable in their own community because they actually run it from their community. They are completely independent. The WCGN is a national umbrella, has no authority over these organizations, and we don't want that authority. We want to encourage them and help them do what they're doing better. So in those difficult times, those women still worked together to fund what they needed. And I think what is so exciting about this new model is that collective giving accesses a new funding source for communities. These are people, these are women who have money that was never considered big enough to go after or to big enough to pay attention to, let's say. But now, because it's collective, these women have a lot of potential to make a large difference in their community in any way they choose to.
You bring up an interesting point, so let's expand on that a little bit, because when you say the word philanthropy, the thing that comes to mind is the guy on the Monopoly card with the money bag.
Exactly.
You think of rich people, really rich people, giving great sums of money for terrific organizations or causes. People who contribute to charity, who send a check for $25 to the American Cancer Society or whatever, don't consider themselves to be philanthropists, but they are, in fact, engaged in philanthropy. So you're allowing people to come in who are not wealthy to have tremendous impact. Is that correct?
That is precisely the point. The face of philanthropy is really changing in America, and it can be any color, any age, but the new face is a woman's. And so we are giving women those situations, if they are interested in making a difference in their community, they can combine with one another. They can determine how much money they would like to put into collectively, and they can determine where that money goes, and they can learn how to do it. So it is a change. You are no longer, as you said, the man on the Monopoly card. We are many, many, many faces, and they are very strong, and they are very informative of what they're doing, and they are making a huge impact in their communities.
One of the other things is that women are not aware that other women, in many cases, are involved in philanthropy to this degree and on this scale and having this kind of an impact. So in addition, it seems to me, to raising money and pooling those resources for a greater impact, are you also raising awareness of women that they should be and are, in fact, already in many cases involved in this kind of thing?
Mike, one of the sessions at our conference, which I know we're going to get to talk about more in the program, is called Who's Afraid of Philanthropy? Because women do demur and are reluctant to really claim that status as philanthropists. And so we're spending some time at the conference really encouraging and empowering the leaders that are traveling to Charlotte to own that title.
Well, let's go through some of the conference is, in fact, sold out. So if you haven't already registered for it, you can't go. But what will people take away from this?
Sonia Nichols, who's my co-chair, who unfortunately was not able to be here this morning. And if you've not met Sonia yet, Mike, you really need to. She is a force to be reckoned with and really quite extraordinary. But we have worked with a national group of volunteers to create a program around the themes of doing, being, leading. Doing, of course, is the nuts and bolts of how we organize our groups, everything from membership recruitment to grant-making due diligence, to evaluation programs. The being part is an essential component of this conference. We believe as women leaders that unless we take care of ourselves, we certainly will not have the energy and the vision and the passion to really move the meter in our communities, which leads obviously to the leading part. Mm-hmm. We have wonderful, wonderful role models coming to talk with us as leaders. Darla Moore is our keynote speaker. And the topic that she selected for us is really quite breathtaking. It is about community engagement, educational equity, racial justice. She talks very directly about the Charleston tragedy. And so we're really quite honored and delighted to have her.
She has the School of Business at USC in Columbia.
Yes, she does.
Who don't know her. The way you talk about the women who are involved in this collective and in the individual organizations around the country that make up this collective is that they're doing a lot of homework. They're looking at grant proposals. They are looking at organizations. They're looking at the leadership of those organizations. They're looking at the impact and how those organizations are run. They are doing a lot of hard, detailed work. If this were 1955, all these women would be housewives with plenty of time to do this. Today, women are not. They are in careers. They're usually responsible for the house, even though they and their husbands both work. They're still, all the work has still fallen on them. How do they have time to do all this work? Why do they want to take on all of this extra work?
Well, the Women's Impact Fund, we divide and conquer. We grant in five areas, as I mentioned earlier, and we have five work teams consisting of between 10 and 15 each that do the research in the community to determine what the emerging needs are. And then they review the proposals that they receive, and they usually get about 20 each for one grant in each category. And they've refined a process by which they can get the information they need in a way that is not burdensome on the organization, because we know their chances of actually getting one of our grants is infinitesimally small. And so we want to be respectful of our time, but smart, but also respectful of the resources of the organization. Mike, why do they do it? Mm-hmm. Why do they submit an application when they know it's like winning the philanthropic lottery? And they do it because they know that if they are successful, it's not just the money that we invest, it's the additional dollars that we influence. We really are viewed as the Women's Impact Fund as a kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval for these organizations. And when they have been successful in earning one of our grants, additional dollars always follow.
Diane mentioned a little while ago that anybody can do this. Anybody can join these various organizations around the country that are part of this giving collective. All they have to do is want to be there, and whatever the level of giving in that particular organization may be, have the resources to do that. But then they have to do all this work. And I'm curious, Colleen, how difficult it is to get people up to speed, because some of this work that they have to do, you probably have no experience with in your real life. How difficult is it? And are there resources available to help these individual women understand what they have to know to make these decisions?
Well, most of us, thank you for that opportunity. Most of us in our organizations, as we grow, obviously there's a growth pattern for smaller organizations. That's one of the values of the conference, because organizations that are just beginning are going to have access to a great level of experience. But this business of the time difference between 1955 and today, and how do you make adjustments for that? In Seattle, we have quite an organized grant-making process and a handbook that is published and used. But in advance, we have the dates all outlined as to when these workshops are going to take place. We work from within our organizations. When we're studying how do you review the finances of an organization, we reach into our own membership and find those who are accountants and lawyers to deliver those workshops. So you can follow that through with many of the situations.
Let me jump in here and interrupt for just a second, because we have to take a break. Colleen Willoughby is the one speaking at the moment. She's the founder of the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, and I'll let you complete that thought when we come back from the break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet, presenting Fall Works, merging three unique ballets into one performance with music, including Vivaldi's Four Seasons and a live bluegrass band. Thursday through Saturday at Knight Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. And Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at diamondsprings.com. The United States, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea have all emerged as major players in the new world of cyber warfare. And on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes, they will be talking about global security threats posed by increasingly sophisticated malware and the new digital arms race. That's on Diane Rehm at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. Look for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
I'll stay on as majority leader, but the one thing I found in talking to everybody, if we are going to unite and be strong, we probably need a fresh face.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Roberts dominated in North, East, and West Charlotte, and turnout was 6%, low but higher than expected.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about women and philanthropy. 60% of the decisions about where philanthropic money is being spent are being made by women around the country. This is a recent paradigm shift, one would think. But the problem with this, as I said in the very beginning, is that a lot of women don't know this. They don't know the kind of impact that their fellow women are having or can have, particularly if they use this model that we're talking about, where you pool your resources. And that's a model that was devised by Colleen Willoughby, one of our guests, who joins us by phone from Seattle. She's the founder of the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, which we've shortened to WCGN. It's a great radio station out in the Midwest and plays top 40 music. Virginia Mills is the board chair of that organization. She joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Diane Bailey's in our studio. She's the co-chair of the National Leaders Forum, the Women's Collective Giving Forum, which is taking place here this week. Unfortunately, it's already sold out, but you're learning a lot of the things that you would learn had you gone to that. She's also the president of the local organization, the Women's Impact Fund. You wanted to jump in on something that Colleen was saying a second ago. And that, because I asked about time commitment, because see, women today are busier than they've ever been, and probably a lot busier than some of the men. But you say an uninvolved check writer is welcome.
We love happy check writers, absolutely. One of the initial selling points when we were creating the Women's Impact Fund is that there would be no attendance requirements. Certainly, you are welcome to participate in a grant-making work team. You are welcome to attend our educational and social events, but we will not send you a letter of reprimand if you don't come.
But isn't being involved in this organization, your organization, and all of these organizations that this umbrella encourages, isn't part of it being involved? Isn't part of it learning about the things that you're giving money to, making the decisions about who to give the money to? Because it's also about empowerment. It's not just about writing a check.
That's absolutely what it's about. It's about learning about the needs of the community and learning how you can then address those needs. Our primary vehicle for doing that is investment of capital philanthropically. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned earlier, we also invest our human resources, our intellectual capital, our passion, our enthusiasm to make these organizations stronger. I'd say the other part of being engaged and perhaps the most important part for me are the amazing relationships you develop. The women that are drawn to the Women's Impact Fund are smart, they're sophisticated, they're fun, they're kind, and to be able to develop those relationships across a large spectrum of ages, personal and professional backgrounds is truly such a blessing.
I'm not sure to address this question, too. Maybe all three of you can jump in here and talk about this, because I know that the various models, there are different models with different organizations around the country, but Colleen, the one that I believe, well, I read an article, one of them says that members pledge $2,000 a year. $1,000 goes to the cause of their choice. The other $1,000 is put into the pool of money that the collective organization is working with to be doled out to causes selected by the membership. Is $1,000, $2,000 the general floor of all of this, or is it different from city to city, organization to organization? Can it be $100, for instance?
$200 is the lowest level that mm-hmm. exists currently within our network, but it's up until $10,000 is the highest level within the network currently. One of the beautiful things about this model, as Virginia pointed out, is it's very organic, and it bubbles up in communities to take on the personalities of its members in ways that are not ever duplicated.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the rest of the country, Virginia.
Well, we have, as I mentioned, 46 groups around the country. As Diane mentioned, they could be also putting dues in of $200 each or $10,000 each. It doesn't really matter. They determine who they would like to fund, what categories. It could be arts. It could be women and children. It could be health. It's all in their hands to determine that. But one of the common features of these organizations is that women are welcome at every level of experience. And they may know only how to write a check. They may know nothing about this process. And it is about meeting them where they are and joining into the fold, because women love connection. They love to do things together, and they love to see benefits. Now they're learning the benefits of their dollars being pooled together for real impact. So we train people. We train these ladies to do what they do in their own homes, perhaps, but they're going to be doing that kind of philanthropy in their own home even better. So it actually trickles down to the individual household in that manner.
Was that part of your thought process, Colleen, when you decided to start this umbrella organization, the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, was that women can not only give money and see their money have an impact in the community, because collectively pooling a lot of dollars can have a lot of impact, more than just writing a check for $100 or $25.
Well, I think
but it's part of it, the fact that that these women would then learn how to do these things and learn about what a worthy organization is run like. And that's a bad way to phrase that that question, but is that part of it?
No, they do learn all of those things, and they form an engagement that really extends over a period of time. I often try to make the difference, and you did talk a little bit about the difference between philanthropy and charity. Charity is often a responsive act. You want to support the American Cancer Society, or you want to support your church, or your contribution to the United Way. Philanthropy is your individual engagement in an issue or a area of interest that you want to really stay with for a long period of time. And I think that the training wheels of how you do that by learning about the organization or the competitive organizations in that particular field, it's just there's no end to the learning. And I think that's what keeps women coming, because each meeting, each workshop, each time that they're sitting next to someone at a lecture, you just keep learning. But what I'd like to bring out is that this is a particularly good time in history for these training wheels to be operative in our country. The current growth of wealth that women have, and wealth is relative, we've talked about it, you mentioned the perception is that a philanthropist is only a very rich person. Well, I think we have demystified that with these organizations, that you can enter at various levels of wealth. There's no particular definition of that. But the other thing is that the women that are learning to use their wealth are bringing dollars into the community that would not be there necessarily if they did not do it. The community would not have the benefit of the financial resources that women are bringing to the table, so that it isn't just dependent on the men in our lives to support that. And I think Diane made the comment about influence. We have a sort of a mantra in the Seattle group saying it's not only the money we give, but it's the money we influence. There is a tremendous ripple effect from all of this experience that the members of our organizations are learning at the table, at the dinner table. I think the influence that we have with our spouse, if we have one, or our best friend in corporate life. I think very often the knowledge that we have influence is what some corporate responsibilities use as their data. The other important part about having women involved in this is families and children. I think helping our young people to learn that philanthropy is something natural. It isn't a special characteristic, but you grow with it. And that influence is really important. The other thing that's happening is that there is the expectation of a great transfer of wealth over the next few decades. And it's important for women to understand, since actuarial tables tell us that women live longer, to have a really educated knowledge, I call it training wheels, on how the importance of philanthropy can enrich communities, but it also enriches lives and there are some skills that are easy to learn, and you keep going.
Diane.
Colleen mentioned the ripple effect, and it's something we talk about a lot and experience in the Women's Impact Fund. We have seen our members grow as leaders, both in terms of the amount they give to the community, the ways they engage as volunteers, as members of boards of directors, as presidents of boards of directors. We have also seen our members change their careers, moving from corporate America to serve as executive directors and CEOs of nonprofits that they became engaged with only through their membership in Women's Impact
Fund. That comes back
to
something that I read in an article where Colleen was quoted, and she said that once women think of themselves as philanthropists, they dig down and discover their own potential. You're saying that they find out things about themselves that they didn't know, and that maybe shifts the course of their lives.
Their lives, the lives of their families, the lives of our communities. Absolutely.
And I want to get back to, because I think this needs to be said a couple of times in this show. I want to get back to the difference between charity and philanthropy, and the fact that what I'm hearing you say, Virginia and Colleen and Diane, is that charity is writing a check to help somebody because they need help. You're going to support the United Way. You're going to support the Children's Fund, whatever it may be. Philanthropy is having an impact. Philanthropy is doing something with your dollars that really change things in some fundamental way, and that this way of doing it, this collective giving, amplifies the dollars that you may have, whether it's $100 or whether it's $5,000. Now it becomes, it's just like the NPR fund drives, the public radio fund drives, these challenge grants that we have. It's exactly like that. It amplifies the money.
Exactly.
Agreed. I do want to, the United Way, I would challenge you, is absolutely engaged in philanthropy. In our community, we've seen that they have become extremely focused and strategic in their goals and in pursuit of those goals. So I want to clarify that there. But philanthropy it's a state of being, right? It is a way in which you engage with your community in a way that is purposeful and intentional, and to the name of our organization, has impact.
Mm-hmm. Colleen, I think you wanted to jump in there. I heard you try to talk.
No, I was just saying that it is that the long-term relationship of your leading your passion. An example of this, on 9/11 many years ago, the YWCA in the city of Seattle had their annual event. They were trying to decide whether to have it or not have it because of the emotional shock of the community. They decided to go with it. And it was interesting, the woman that was awarded their big award for that luncheon ended her comment by saying, find something in your city that you love and then love it for a lifetime. I think that's a definition of philanthropy, that it isn't a quick fix to something. It's an opportunity for all of us to find something in our, whether it's agriculture, whether it's horticulture, whether it's children's health, but it's a vehicle that helps you to love that passion that you personally have for a lifetime. It doesn't mean that you do that exclusively and you don't help a bundle of charities that you also love, but there is something that really touches your heart that you want to stay with. And this becomes a vehicle of learning how to be a philanthropic investor. I mean, it is a difference between investing in something and just making an annual contribution to something.
Before Colleen started this, Virginia, she saw what she says. She saw what she called a tremendous disconnect between the capacity of women and how they were spending for charitable purposes. And when they collectivize this money, they suddenly see this impact. They do, in fact, become, in the bigger capital letter word, philanthropists. They become philanthropists. Have you noticed, both in your capacity at the local level in Boston and also in your capacity as board chair of this umbrella organization, that when, and it wouldn't just be women, but people, when people suddenly see themselves as philanthropists, does their capacity for philanthropy increase over time because they see the impact?
Yes, would be my short answer. I believe that when one becomes aware of that shift in your perception, it opens many new doors into yourself. It allows you to be more philanthropic, perhaps in your own dollars, because you're more confident in the ability to make wise and strategic decisions. It also changes how you view the world, and it also impacts how you talk to others about what you are doing. And I'd like to say that the WCG and the Women's Collective Giving Grantmakers Network, which is the umbrella organization, exists to help these individual organizations, like in Seattle and in Charlotte, to do what they do even better. We are providing more training than they have internally, which is quite a bit that they already have. We provide access to peer-to-peer learning. We share best practices. And we are there to help all of these organizations improve in their philanthropic endeavors, to see themselves even more as those philanthropic individuals, and doing it also together. Doing that philanthropy in a shared way is very powerful for women.
Diane, we have about 1 minute left.
For better or for worse, the National Leadership Forum is completely oversubscribed, as we've discussed. But I do want listeners in Charlotte to remember to go to womensimpactfund.org and consider joining us today. The conversation absolutely will continue in the weeks and months and year to come, and we would welcome anyone who's interested in membership.
The Charlotte Women's Impact Fund started in 2003. It's become one of the largest, fastest-growing women's giving circles in the country. To what do you attribute that success?
It hits a need in our community, and it is, as I mentioned before, the most vibrant, engaged, sophisticated, smart, fun, and kind and compassionate women. So please do consider joining us.
That's Diane Bailey, who is president of the Women's Impact Fund here in Charlotte and the co-chair of the National Leaders Forum, the Women's Collective Giving Forum here in town, which is sold out, but it's this week in Charlotte. Colleen Willoughby is the founder of that organization, and Virginia Mills is the board chair. I want to thank all three of you for the hour.